Someone once told me that no one says life is fair. When you hear that when you're young, you have no idea what it really means. Once you've lived a little, and then you lose everything, suddenly it makes sense. This podcast is a true life memoir of someone who lost everything and is rebuilding in search of who they once were. They're sharing their story as part of their healing process, and so that anyone else out there living through similar circumstance knows that they're not alone. Hey everybody, Dave the Clone here with another installment in the ongoing saga of the Feeling It, Healing It, A Diary of Recovery. The long and sordid tale of somebody putting the pieces back together after having their life completely shattered. Kind of like the way Neo jumped into Agent Smith and shattered him from within. Only, the more and more I'm watching movies intently with the expectation of being able to talk about them for anywhere from a half an hour to 45 minutes on the other podcast that I've been producing for the last, I guess it'll be 20 weeks or so. It's been dawning on me more and more that, I don't know, looking at things as if they would always have this analogous way of being described by scenes in a movie has for some time, more than I'm happy about, really kind of served towards my detriment. I think I'm feeling a real sense of loss of innocence with all that in these later days where things are becoming clearer and I'm starting to, I guess, be on the mend in general. I don't know. It's part of the sort of, I know I keep mentioning that I'd much rather be doing another music therapy episode. And there is some new music I've been listening to, or at least more like new treatments of old music that I've been listening to that I guess in some ways, if I were to be looking at my life as if it were a movie, it would show a progression or evolution or one of those kind of strange reprisals where you're kind of towards the latter part of the film, maybe towards the end of the second act or going into the third act where you hear a familiar melody, only maybe instead of the actual song itself, it's kind of like a lullaby version or a different style of music, but it's playing the same melody. And that shows, you know, something has changed, but that little familiarity reminds you of the thing that was going on at the beginning that that really kind of kicked the whole thing into gear. In fact, one of the things, I guess since I did stumble into talking about music here, one of the things I have been noticing is I've been listening to music that was some of the first music I downloaded or added to playlists on my Spotify, which was a hallmark of the beginning of this relationship that was kind of the door swinging open to Armageddon for me. And one of the things I definitely know I've been doing for the last 2 years has been avoiding music from that era. And I think what I expected was partially to maybe never listen to some of that stuff again. In the same way that I had avoided TV shows and movies from that time period as well. And I was struck by how little it was affecting me in the way of, at least, you know, it wasn't restarting the depression. It wasn't creating the sense of loss that I feel like has been sort of numbing itself or maybe healing in that way. I found I was actually able to enjoy some of that music again, some songs, although I did go on a little bit of a Facebook rampage one night, posting links with little caveated messages above them saying, isn't it a damn shame that, you know, this track is so memory connected to the biggest regret of my life. And I've even started to kind of get the sense of, I don't know, maybe this is what growing up is, right? When you start to take a look at some of the things you do and go, why the hell are you doing that? You know, like, is it funny? Do you really care? Are you really here trying to entertain the masses? I mean, or is it time to redefine and look at some of the opportunity that I have? What, you know, when they say that you kind of get to this level where you even can look at the bad things that happened and start to see the possible reasons that they happened and how they were sort of necessary, you know, and I don't know if this is part of the spiritual journey I'm on, where you're starting to look at like everything falling into place according to a higher plan, and how we're not supposed to understand them while we're going through them, and that even when we think we understand them, it's really not our place to understand them. It's really not what we're here to do, but I guess it kind of helps. And I guess just in general, there's this weirdness still around the idea that when I think about where I'm at now, and we are going into, I'm going into week number two as a newly employed person. Not that I wasn't unemployed before, but I'm actually on the books. I'm having to answer emails. I'm having to make myself available for certain periods of time. It's, you know, a little bit back to what I used to call normal. And there's a sense of comfort there. But at the same time, it's also helping me bring some new structure back into my life and really look at, okay, using all of my day much more efficiently. Anyone who's really eagle-eyed will notice that this episode got posted a little bit later than the previous 43 of them have, because I actually got a little bit, you know, it's like, you know, it's up in the air when you're first starting something new, right? You're kind of having to restructure the way that you spend your time, and sometimes time slips away. So in any case, it's a good thing. Things are kind of feeling like they're moving in that right direction. But yeah, there's also coming with that this kind of sense of, you know, there's just a part of me that realizes that where I'm at right now, knowing that it's something that I actually feared, and realizing that I may have completely manifested this situation subconsciously, I wish that would unlock the magical powers of manifestation that I've been talking about and that I've been reading about and that I've been studying, to really kind of have some kind of switch flip where life, like, you know, the light comes on and life really does kind of turn the corner. I know that one of the things I've kind of grown an appreciation for is the whole idea of nothing worth having comes easily or without doing the work. I think it's been a long time before I kind of realized what that meant, you know, what the work actually is. And I've been noticing that the mornings have been a little bit less consisting of feeling like the bully of anxiety is waiting for me to wake up. There have been more mornings than not in the last few weeks where I wake up just kind of feeling like, okay, let's go. Got to go for a walk because I got to get back so that I can do a few other things before I have to kind of log in and sign on and be at the ready. But it's kind of neat to actually be getting the response to the work that I do. And the company I'm working for is completely virtual, so everybody sort of checks in on these Zoom calls at least once a week, and you wind up talking to people in all different time zones. So it kind of feels like you're part of this I guess I almost want to say Star Trek in the way that I describe it. This kind of like far-reaching, multifaceted thing. It's neat. It's kind of cool. It's definitely. It makes me realize there was some value in letting the old world come back a little bit. You know, there was a part of me that I think in some ways was looking at it as like a sign of failure that I wasn't able to figure things out more on my own or as a freelancer. But in reframing that and looking at things in the, well, no, this could be the way, you know what I mean? The team that I'm on is like a full blown marketing team. And the company itself, while it services a particular niche of the world, also is operating kind of like a creative agency, right? And so the idea being that right now I have a certain baseline number of hours that I have to work to qualify for healthcare and things of that nature. But at the same time, there are going to be new clients that they bring on that they offer my services to, which will then expand my hours, but will also expand my reach. You know, one of the things I've been struggling with that I didn't realize that I guess maybe I haven't even been able to verbalize because I haven't been able to look at it in this light is that the rejection that I've been feeling all this time from this job search really had me starting to think that this thing that I thought I was good at, this whole idea of being this video professional, may have either run its course or maybe I just wasn't ever as good as I thought I was. Because if I was, why has nobody been gung-ho about me being a part of their world? You know, why has nobody said, yeah, dude, come on, join the team? And it's interesting because I mentioned this to a buddy of mine from college, and he was like, yeah, you know, I'm getting pissed about it too, because the phenomenon happening right now with these kind of ghost posts and these sort of positions that aren't really positions, that they're just posted because they already want to hire somebody or elevate somebody internally, but because of whatever, they have to at least say they made the effort, so they post the job. I think there's also this kind of concerted effort of looking for who will do the job for the least amount of money. And it's been a real struggle to kind of keep things like that in the perspective you need to keep them in. Because granted, you know, the world is on a seriously strange tilt right now. And as much as it sucks, and as much as it sucks to have to look it in the face, there's also something to the idea that you can't control what you can't control, right? There's things that are going to be too big. I know I've kind of gone down this road before on this podcast. There are going to be things that are well outside your control. And so you kind of have to just step back and realize what is within your sphere to be able to kind of handle or work with. And, you know, like if there's a war on the working class, at least getting back into the employed world to the degree that I have is a step in the right direction towards avoiding complete calamity. And I have to be able to get to the, you know, that's what I really, the mentality that's out there of some people who are able to understand these truths, and just because you can see, okay, I can't control everything. Some of these things are too big for me. So I'm not going to spend the time worrying. I'm not going to spend the time stressing about something that, one, I can't do anything about, and two, stressing about doesn't help. So all you're doing, it's almost like, and maybe this is also because I'm so pissed that we lost the hour of sleep this week with spring forward, with daylight savings, but it's almost like you start to really feel the toll of that worrying places on you. The Princess Bride, I've just sucked 1 hour of your life away effect of, you know, being upset about things like that. And so I'm kind of, there's days where I feel like I'm there. But for the most part, there are also still days where, even though I didn't wake up with it, somehow during the course of the day, the anxiety of all of it will rise up. And instead of succumbing to the fear, which is what my natural response to that has been, I'm trying to use it as the fuel to motivate figuring out, okay, I've got this in place now. And there are plenty of indicators that there is going to be more work coming down the pike from this job, that there's a very good chance this job could go full time in the next 6 months. You know, they said, you know, we're going to kind of see how things go for the next month or two. But if I'm constantly logging way more hours than was expected, we may have to sort of revisit the situation and say, does it make more sense for me to be full time? And if so, that's fine too. I think the way that this was positioned to me is, not only are these people that I've known for almost two full decades now and worked with during that time in various capacities, both when I was at my old job and then again, and then as a freelance contractor, but they also wanted to help, but also wanted to be sensitive to and give me the freedom to continue to pursue other things through my freelance work, so that I didn't feel completely tied down, I guess. And as sad as it is to say, that there's been a certain amount of mentality where it's like, yeah, you know, okay, I might be getting past that. I might just be like, it's much better to not be starving. It's much better to not be homeless. So, and I know, again, the whole idea of I'm putting this pressure on myself about, feeling like I'm a burden to my folks right now. And I don't like that feeling. And so I want to be able to do something about that. Yeah, I need to find a way to let that go a little bit, but I also feel like part of my, keeping myself accountable is to just keep that in mind, but not in such a way that it causes the level of distress that becomes crippling, debilitating depression. And for as much as I found, you know, the sort of solace of escape in movies and TV shows, I do find myself kind of continuing to gravitate towards the old. You know, I didn't watch the Oscars. I know that's a big deal. A lot of people still watch that. And one of the things I've been finding is, like, you know, I didn't watch them, but I obviously saw the clip of Al Pacino and his odd gaffe, I guess, when announcing Best Picture. I didn't find it as shocking, but the headline was like, confusion abounds as Al Pacino, you know, flubs announcing the Best Picture. And I feel like there's a certain sadness that comes now with also seeing how much time has passed. You know, when I think Al Pacino, I still think of Al Pacino in Heat. Or I just recently watched Godfather 1 and 2 the other last couple days while I was doing work. I had them on in the background. And, you know, vintage young Pacino. In fact, Godfather 2 is where Screaming Al, I think, was born. And it's kind of hard to always think of them like that. And then you see this thing and you're like, oh my God, he's actually kind of become an old man. And, you know, he's 83. What the hell do I want from this guy? But I feel like it's these acknowledgments that then will kick off that weird feedback loop of like, dude, you're not young either. You know what I mean? You don't have a lot of time. I think that's why I'm constantly trying to figure out. I mean, there is a certain amount of resentment that comes up when I think about the fact that there are people half my age who've made millions of dollars by posting shit videos on YouTube. And I need to figure out a way to be less aggressive in that opinion, because as much as I think that it's shit videos, if that's how you make money on YouTube, then that's how you make money on YouTube. And I need to put my money where my mouth is if I'm this upset about where I'm at in life, and find a way to get okay with it so that I can make the same kind of videos and try to make the same kind of money. And that's just one of the ways people use the internet to make money. I hate to admit that the state of the world puts me in a sense of desperation that this is really going to be the only way I'm going to be able to survive whatever this wave of horribleness that's coming our way, according to Robert Kiyosaki, the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, who keeps saying, you know, there's a crash coming. It's going to be bad. It's going to be intense. Lots of people are going to lose a lot. And then he'll, in the same breath, go, but the good thing about that is that when that happens, that's when you get rich. And I'm like, if rich means having the most bottle caps, like it's a big game of Fallout, I don't know if that's the kind of rich I'd like to be. And I certainly don't want that to be the kind of world I'm rich in. You know what I mean? Who wants to live in the wasteland? As much as I love the Mad Max movies, I've always seen them as cautionary tales more than instructional videos, much like all the dystopia of 80s and 90s movies. I have to admit a certain level of disappointment with the world. Like, how did we in two generations after I grew up get to the point where people aren't seeing those images or those worlds being described in those stories as something to be avoided? Like, why are we diving head first? And why is there no sense? You know what it is? It's the feeling that there are no heroes. It's the feeling that there never were any heroes, or that the age of heroes, to get back to Mad Max, the age of heroes is over. It's like, yeah, so we've all been dumbed down so much that we're going to march right into our own demise and not actually put up a fight, you know? I'm not saying I'm, you know, too jazzed about the idea of having to be a part of a revolution or anything like that. But if it came down to it, like, what if there is that test, you know? What if the world does come to the point where it's like, look, if we don't stand up, then we just, I don't want us to have to become the slaves and then have to revolt. I'd love us to avoid that part of it happening. And when I watch some of these older movies, like I just did Gross Point Blank for the 15 minutes of Movie Memory Madness podcast. 15 minutes of Movie Memory Madness on the HolloNet Network. And instead of just being able to enjoy the movie and enjoy it and think, oh, hey, is this kind of, you know, well, hold on, let me figure out a way to say what I'm thinking here. Instead of just enjoying the movie for what it was, I found myself transported back to 17-year-old Dave in high school watching this movie when it came out and thinking, there is no way in hell the world that 44-year-old Dave is living in now was the world that was waiting for us. And I think what made me think this is because this movie's about a guy who goes back to his high school reunion, his 10-year high school reunion. In the 10 years since he graduated high school, he has been working as a professional hitman, a freelance hitman. He started his own company. He's got a front organization. He's made significant money. He goes back, and a lot of people in the 10 years after high school have made significant money, have made significant gains and strides in their lives. And I, at the time that I saw that movie, was left with the impression that that's what adult life was going to be like. In fact, it was one of the reasons I had for a long time very much looked forward to going to my high school reunion whenever it wound up happening. Well, one of the things that I now am realizing should have been a herald of the fact that the future wasn't going to be the way I expected was that when my 10-year reunion came around, not only did it seem like not a big deal, at least not anywhere near the big deal it was in my imagination when it finally arrived, but it wasn't even like a return home kind of thing. The committee, the people, I don't know if any of them listen to this, but if they do, they've heard this before. They've seen me post about it on Facebook. I've shit posted about this for a long time because clearly I'm disappointed and have a chip on my shoulder. But it was a sign of this version of the world now, because the folks who were on the committee, I guess the class officers, were all people whose lives had taken them into big, scary New York City, right? Which by that time in the late 90s, early 2000s, early 2010s, was a bit of a more cleaned up version, less of a hellscape, less of the hellscape it was in the 80s and has now sort of returned to in the 2020s. It was the Demolition Man version of New York, I guess. And instead of wanting to go back to their hometown, they decided our 10-year reunion is going to be a happy hour at a bar in the city. So, which kind of, in a lot of ways, now, the people, when I've first complained about this on Facebook, said, hey, look, we did a survey, and that's what most people who responded to the survey said they'd want to do. And I'm like, I didn't get any fucking survey, so I don't know who you surveyed. And it just felt like this is a generational thing. This is a thing where the people who are my contemporaries just didn't see any sort of inherent value in this tradition. For them, it's like, let's just make this convenient. Let's just make it a fucking happy hour. And whoever is in the city and whoever wants to come into the city, we'll all meet at this bar. Now, to me, I know this is probably such a little thing to sort of obsess over and to hyper focus on, but it just kind of, it screamed to me, yeah, fuck it. Let's just make it a cool kids reunion. You know, my parents, when I was growing up, when they would go to events like this and they came home and would have such great stories about what it was like to see people after not seeing them for so long, I felt like who wouldn't want to do that? You know, who wouldn't want to go to a wedding reception that didn't require sitting through a wedding? You know, that's what I kind of saw a class reunion was sort of supposed to be. You know, it was sort of like a prom after 10 years, but we're all older and can drink. You know what I mean? And to see people that I grew up with who also saw this fucking movie treat it like, fuck it, let's just do a happy hour at a bar, is sort of like, oh my God. And that's such a microcosm of the sort of blasé, apathetic entitlement, sort of just make everything easy for me, that the world I perceive around me has become. So, not taking that as the sign for how much worse it was going to get. That was my first disappointment, besides the fact that by the time it had rolled around, I wasn't married, didn't have a family, didn't create my freelance hitman business where I was a friggin' pocket millionaire. And to see that the actual way to do that was to have been on the leading edge of YouTube, where I already felt that was a huge drop in standards of quality, and to see what it's bottomed out to now is kind of horrific. It just kind of, I don't know what I'm getting at here. It's sort of like, all right, and here's to complete the circle of what else I wanted to say about this. For a long time, I thought, why has there never been a sequel to that movie? This movie was such a great, the idea of a hitman going to his high school reunion, it's such a brilliant concept, and how you never expect people from the town you grew up in to wind up where they wind up. There's always like one or two people who have these really exceptional lives. And in general, you have to think spies come from somewhere. Everybody had an origin story that could start out. You know, I mean, how many biopics have we seen? There's a new one on Netflix is about Rocco Siffredi, the male porn star. We're actually romanticizing the journey from kid from Italy to become world famous porn star. I know we did it with Boogie Nights. And that was when I was in high school as well. So maybe that was laying the groundwork for where we are with the OnlyFans culture. But when you think that everybody came from somewhere, the idea of this kind of quirky, dark comedy, satirical kind of look at what would it be like if a hitman went back to his high school reunion to try to rekindle the flame with his long lost love, his high school sweetheart, who he hasn't seen in 10 years, who he left jilted on prom night. Instead of going to the prom with her, he went and joined the army and became the, you know, the proto Martin Blank that we see at the end of the movie. Even after all the sort of things it deals with, that I feel like watching it again with 44-year-old eyes, you have a totally different interpretation and appreciation for. I still think, all right, why did they never make a sequel? In fact, when I went to Dragon Con in 2017, I had the opportunity to ask John Cusack directly in front of hundreds and hundreds of people, hey, are Martin Blank and John Wick friends? Now, this is going to set the stage here for what I'm about to say, because they dress the same. They sort of are both unkillable. I mean, Martin Blank, for it being a comedy and for it being John Cusack, who wasn't really an action star or anything, he was the guy who constantly got away from the bad guys. He was the guy who nobody could actually get the drop on. He was like the most badass, but casual badass. Well, fast forward to the 2012. When did John Wick come out? I want to say 2012, but it was probably actually 2008, maybe. I'm Google machining while we talk here. But anyway, any case, this is where I'm getting at, is when you ask why was there not another Martin Blank? Why was there never a sequel to Gross Point Blank? It's because we did get it. It's John Wick. And look at what that world is. John Wick is basically the same story. It's a guy who was such a badass hitman, he actually was able to get himself out of being obligated to the Russian mob by pretty much destroying most of it single-handedly. They claim they gave him an impossible task, and he was able to succeed. They didn't expect him to be able to do it. Now, what do I mean when I say we have John Wick? John Wick is this sort of, not 2014 was the original John Wick, which is getting close. It's about 10 years ago, right? So it's the beginning of the end. It's 5 years prior to pandemic and real, you know, near apocalypse. And it's just straight up all about the action. It's actually more action over substance. The first one, I don't mean to sound as critical, because the first one I really liked. And the first one featured like things like John Leguizamo and Dean Winters. And there were a lot of characters in the first movie. There was some depth, you know, you got a sense of history. There was the female hitman who clearly had a romantic past with John, and was probably a little pissed that John married somebody and got out of the life. But John was pretty much a killing machine. And then the rest of that franchise just became really just action set pieces with a little bit of dialogue gluing them together. But what I'm saying is, it was a colder world. It was a much more acknowledgement of the darkness of the world. And I think it's ironic that in 2017, I was saying, hey, Martin Blank and John Wick are kind of the same. They could do a crossover movie and take these two worlds and bring, because I mean, John Wick, I mean, Martin Blank is a hitman, with the whole idea behind the sort of B storyline of his movie is the other hitmen are trying to create a union so that they can, you know, collectively bargain over the price of assassination jobs and control the market a little bit. It was hilarious to think of that. But by the time you hit 2014, we're much more open to this kind of nihilistic, oh yeah, of course there's a dark cabal. Of course there's a organized crime world behind everything, and that there's going to be a hotel that all the hitmen go to, and they're the only ones with gold, the sort of recession-proof currency, you know. It wasn't as obvious in 2014, but if you're watching them, like the newer ones now, where it is just kind of like cranked out, rinse, repeat, you know, soulless copies of the formula of the first movie with even less substance, it kind of is an interesting analog of where we seem to be getting and how people will argue about how those movies are good. And you go, what is wrong with you? Why are you cool with this? And it's really weird to realize there's all these people now who weren't around to experience the world pre-social media, the world pre-internet domination, the world of 1996, 1997, the world when Gross Point Blank came out. So all this to say, I'm at this weird point where I'm realizing that there's a very good chance that, like Weezer, the world may have turned and left me behind. And if me being afraid of ever having a point in time where I had to reset and start over from scratch and do so at a time where it's kind of like late in the game and I'm not going to have as much time on the other side of it to enjoy the spoils of victory should I get there. And feeling like I manifested that by being afraid of it 10, 20 years ago. There's also been this part of me that was worried about being one of the people, you know, like when you watch Terminator and there's the sort of post-Judgment Day world where like the resistance humans are kind of living this kind of trash can, everyone's kind of homeless and living off the scraps of society. I always thought if the world were to go that way, and this is before I was even afraid of being, you know, unemployed. So I had this weird thought, that this morbid thought of if the world were to go that way, is my purpose to be the person who's like the old man telling stories around the campfire of what the world was like before it all went to hell? I certainly don't want to manifest that into reality. So I'm trying to think of what can I do to help avoid it happening. But I'm wondering if that's part of the reason I'm drawn to doing stuff like this, like podcasting, and why taking this approach to try to put something out in the world to help other people who've been in my position. I mean, granted, I think it's hard to deny that where I am now, both mentally and geographically, and even actually now that I've started working again for an actual company, I can even say almost financially, at least on the road to being financially in a much different, much better, much more positive position than I was when I started recording these diary entries. It still felt like there's definitely other people out there, and I want to be, you know, a beacon of hope. I want to kind of be like living out loud, healing out loud, healing in front of other people, because I had no idea how to do that. And when I was first kind of pulled into this part of the journey, this part of my existence, the first place I turned to was the digital world. You know, I'm looking up books and listening to books on Spotify and watching video channels on YouTube by psychologists who specialize in people who've been in abusive situations. And it at least gave me this kind of idea, like, okay, this is what we have. 90% of it is garbage. 90% of it is people prostituting themselves. But there's this 10%, maybe 15. Maybe I'm just being cynical. Maybe it's much higher than that. But there is a percentage of people who are putting out content and information designed to help, designed to maintain some part of the human spirit, some part of what makes us worth saving, makes it worth us finding a John Connor to fight the machines. Even John Wick had been pulled from the darkness of the world where he excelled by love and by having a pet, by having a dog. That was an interesting, I think it's so funny that they chose that, because a lot of people, when I first kind of was finding myself struggling for survival here, they said, dude, you know, when you get your own place again, get yourself a dog. Everything's better with a pet, you know. And I just saw a video on LinkedIn the other day talking about how the truest form of loyalty you'll ever really experience is if you have a pet dog. Dogs have this sort of weird connection to this otherworldly set of senses, right? Where the guy in the video is saying, your dog, when you're half a mile away from getting home, your dog can sense that. And that's why when you open the door, the dog is waiting for you at the door, you know, and they don't get upset with you when you're late. I mean, maybe they do in some slight ways, but they never leave you. There's this kind of bond that forms. I mean, even Mad Max. I love how these little parallels keep popping up. It was totally, this show is completely improv'd, I guess, if you couldn't tell. So I don't go into it going, all right, make sure you mention Mad Max, and then 10 minutes later, come back to it with the dog. These things are happening naturally for your healing pleasure and entertainment pleasure and all whatever kind of positivity you can take from this. That's what I do it for, is to see if I can even impress myself with the way these things are going to come together. And I think it's from all the sort of feedback looping of circular logic, which isn't now. Circular logic is something else. Circular logic is what narcissists use when they're gaslighting you. This is more neural pathways, I think, forming live in person, in real time here. But, yeah, so the journey continues, and sometimes the things that we think will remind us of the better time hit us much differently. And I'm wondering if they'll go back to hitting me in a more positive light. I guess what I'm waiting for is to figure out what the signs are that I'm okay. And maybe looking for them is still part of the problem. You know, like I was just saying earlier how I thought if I listen to the songs that used to make me sad and they don't make me feel anything, I'll be okay. But then if I watch a movie that I used to love and it suddenly makes me realize that I knew the world was going to turn to shit, there's something kind of inherently dark or potential, has the potential to backfire with this sort of nostalgia thing. You know, a good example, I didn't watch it when it premiered in 2020, mostly because I didn't have Paramount Plus, but my folks do, and so I'm able to watch some things that I wasn't able to watch earlier. And I finally watched the 2020 miniseries remake of The Stand, which for the longest time, until I read Dune, The Stand was my favorite book. The Stephen King unabridged, uncut, unedited version of The Stand, all 1,300 pages of it. Then I read Dune and I love Dune. I don't even want to talk about Dune though, because I'm kind of almost sick to my stomach with how much people are bitching about Dune on the internet. Either love it or hate it. And this is the other thing too, this kind of fandom rivalry where it's almost like, it's like we can't enjoy shit anymore. Like you can't enjoy something or be a fan of something without being ready to go to battle with those who don't like it. And I don't remember the world of 97, the world of Dave watching Gross Point Blank for the first time, feeling like that was the world we lived in. There were people who were like, oh, I've never seen Gross Point Blank. And you weren't like, well, fuck you and die. It was just like, oh, okay, cool. You should check it out. Like when I asked John Cusack, hey, are John Wick and Martin Blank friends? Are we ever going to see a crossover of their worlds coming together? He's just like, yeah, I haven't seen John Wick, you know. And I'm like, what? Like, aren't you part of that fucking industry? Aren't you guys all supposed to watch each other's stuff? And I was a little disappointed that that was sort of the end of the joke. I thought for sure, like, there would be this kind of conversation that would happen for a minute. The first and only time I ever got to speak to John Cusack, and I had to do it from several hundred yards away. That really sucked. You know, sometimes I used to love convention life. It's been, I think, 3 New Jersey Horror Cons now that I haven't gone to. And I'm a permanent lifetime sponsor of that show. So when people go there, the Hollow Nine logo is on the collateral. There's a poster that will say, thanks to our sponsors, and Hollow Nine logo is there. I have not been there for the last 3 shows. And there's a part of me that kind of, I think in this sort of seeing this time as less of a disaster, less of a catastrophe to recover from. It's almost like a hidden gift of an opportunity to reset and redefine my life. And in part of that, you know, there's almost like this kind of, there's a part of me that's been wondering, would it really be so bad if the message from the universe was like, yeah, dude, you know, the video world's kind of done with you. Maybe you're not even supposed to make movies. I mean, how many stories have come out in the last 5 years? I was just texting with my sister about this because of all the shit that's been coming out about P. Diddy, who, to be fair, I always thought was probably a real douchebag in real life. I mean, he just kind of had that aura about him, like he's a piece of shit. If you're not dollar signs to him, you know, he probably is very much like his character at the beginning of Get Him to the Greek, right? Like I don't know why anybody would aspire to want to be a part of this industry. And I think that kind of goes along with, you know, looking at Al Pacino and going, oh, man, it's so clear that the good time of all this has passed us by. We're beyond the era that where it peaked and has been going downhill. Like, we don't have the stars to replace the stars who are aging out. We don't have the movies that have the same sort of level of art to them or creativity behind them. So much of it feels like an admission of the world is run by the devil. Get used to it. It's about to get a lot worse. Everything kind of has that sort of nihilist / dark evil in the driver's seat. There's so many movies about possession. There's so many movies about demonic entities. I mean, hell, we even had aliens appearing at a mall in Miami, IRL. You know, no one knows what the hell it was, but it very much could have been demons for all we know. There was a time, pretty much in that same time that Gross Point Blank came out, where movies just felt like they were movies. Like, they just felt like they were people telling stories. There was no agendas. There was no sort of everything is a referendum on how you are as a person and how you see the world. And if you don't like a movie, that must mean that you're an ist or a phobe of some kind because this character was a female versus a male. I mean, we've really gotten to the point where our sort of identities and the identity politics are like soaking and saturating everything about the world. And I think in the time where I watched Gross Point Blank as a kid, I did not feel that at all. I didn't think that was going on at all. Now, maybe I was in a place of privilege to come full circle to it. Maybe I'm admitting the place of privilege that I grew up in where I didn't have to think about the world when I was enjoying my entertainment. I was able to just be entertained and think, hey, wouldn't it be fucking awesome to make these one day? Like, to come up with stories that don't necessarily need to make the people who watch them put a stake in the ground and be ready to go to social war over them. I don't know. I don't know what this whole long rant is really supposed to be revealing or exploring. I think it's an interesting time to be healing because of how weird the world is. And I'm trying to figure out if I can really be okay with the idea that this opportunity to redefine my life might be accepting certain levels of what I would have called defeat or failure had I not sort of had the experience of what it's actually like to be brought to your knees, to be brought down to base level zero and have to figure out, well, or at the same time, they say that that's the point you get to where you have no choice but to excel. You have no choice but to be great. You have no choice but to achieve what you are trying to achieve. And you've learned that you really have no one to hold accountable for that besides yourself. And I think it seems like it's something that feels like it should be obvious to all of us. And it feels like something we probably all do have a certain level of understanding of. But, you know how they say you kind of wind up getting trapped in the sort of routine of your life. A lot of that kind of comes from the sort of societal expectations we all had from growing up in the time that I was growing up in, for sure. And we didn't know that we were going to be the bridge between the generations that built the world after the massive sort of reset that things like world wars were, to people who then had it easy because of the world that was built, and now have had it so easy that they have to invent shit to be angry at each other about, to the point where they're so distracted with that, that all these kind of signs that there are a greater evil at work, you know, the sort of the shadow government, if you want to call it that, or the sort of dark forces that are plotting against us. You know, like I used to always say, movies like Mission Impossible were proof that no matter how bad the world seems, there is always just enough more good in it that the scales will never tip, that there's always going to be an Ethan Hunt or a James Bond or a Jason Bourne. There's always going to be that person whose sense of goodness will drive them to be the one to risk jumping from one building to the other just to push a button with only 3 seconds left to go to save the world. And nowadays, it's a little harder to believe in that. And I always wondered if we would get to a point where people have been convinced that they have it so easy. I mean, like I said, there's the kids who have been able to figure out a way to use YouTube to become millionaires who've never had to really push themselves. You know, and I know there's this kind of inherent thought that I hate. I was actually accused of hating sex workers once by a sex worker because of a comment I made about how I don't think it's realistic for somebody who decided to do that as a living may not get the sort of house and white picket fence and 2 and 2.5 kids and dog and all that stuff that used to be part of what we used to call the American dream. And they were like, oh, you must hate sex workers. And I said, no, I just think that somebody who's looking to raise a family is probably not going to be wanting to do it with somebody who's got a digital record of them banging people online for the world to find. And at the same time, you know, I follow plenty of them on Instagram. There's one who I'm actually kind of annoyed with because her content is kind of insipid. But one of the things that struck me is, for no matter how insipid I think she is, which I do think she is, and I kind of feel myself feeling sorry in some ways that, like, you know, okay, you were smart enough to be able to start building an empire doing this, but you don't see your mind as any more valuable than to use it to build an empire doing this. I mean, if you're that smart, you know what I mean? Like, I guess that's the sort of weird catch 22 way I look at it. she says in one of her videos, you know, would you date someone like me who is going to worship you, bang you whenever you want, and also makes a seven-figure salary? And, like, I just got stuck on the seven-figure salary. It's like, all right, yeah, look, that's undeniable. Congratulations, that's banging. We all want that. But it really does feel like this sort of trading of the soul. And I start to wonder, like, not that I'm anybody who would, anyone would want to see that kind of content of, but if I were, would I do it? Just because how can you deny getting to that level where you have the financial freedom and all the comforts that come with it? I don't know. You know, it's an interesting question, and it probably answers my whole thing about, like, you know, all right, is it worth trading your soul? I don't know. I mean, we won't know for sure until the world ends, until we move on to the next plane of existence. But, you know, it's hard to deny that there's probably a certain level of the stress and anxiety that waits for me every morning that these folks don't go through, because they can pay their bills and they don't have the IRS coming after them, for they have the money to pay them when they do, you know. And it's like, we, I guess we all got to figure out what our level of acceptance would be with doing, quote unquote, what it takes. Right. But I there's a part of me that just feels like, you know, it does feel more like it makes sense that there is a way for each of us to figure out how to do that. And you might not have to wind up prostituting yourself to do it. And so I guess that's where I start saying, all right, am I giving up on my dreams by thinking, well, maybe it's something else I'm supposed to do to get myself to that level? Maybe it wasn't ever supposed to really be filmmaking. Maybe recognizing that most of the people involved in that industry are miserable or turn out to be, you know, pedophiles, or wind up having real bouts with drugs. I'm at 450 days of sobriety, and, you know, the temptation has resurfaced from time and time again of saying, I really could use getting blazed right about now. Maybe I wouldn't care about the anxiety so much, but, you know, I'd much rather be able to say I've been able to fight it and get through it. But I know that what I'm fighting, there are things that are hundreds and thousands of times more physically addictive that people wind up getting hooked on and have to fight against. And so, you know, is it the same battle? It probably isn't. But at the same time, temptation is temptation, and I know what it's like, and I know what it's like to kind of be beyond it and then have it crop up again. So there's always an empathy. There's always an empathy for everybody who's doing what they have to do. I just feel like the world didn't ever seem to me like it was going to be the kind of place where so much of it was like, all right, you've made a choice now that's going to live forever. You know, a lot of the people that I went to college with, we all say, man, thank God we didn't have the cell phones that recorded every minute of every day. Thank God we weren't at the point where people were just posting their whole lives and then getting shocked when people judge them or when it sets like a precedent. I mean, I've considered an awful lot of why don't I do things that are a little bit more controversial on the internet, you know, video wise. Why don't I expand on these opinions I have that might not be super popular? And part of me was like, well, I didn't want to hamper my ability to get a job, but here I have been struggling to get a job anyway. And there are plenty of people making money, just as much money, doing, you know, controversial opinions on YouTube as there are people making money doing OnlyFans. And so have I been blocking myself from a possibility there? Who knows? You know, I certainly get defensive and argumentative enough when people call me out for things that I feel like are even sort of on the mild side of being controversial. And I do really lament that we live in a world where people have to self-censor or feel pressured to self-censor because having an opinion that isn't popular has become the thing that makes you into a pariah more so now than ever before. So it's definitely an interesting world of pick your battles, but, you know, how many more years can it go where, like, even living small in that way doesn't wind up being something that I regret? I don't know. this is an interesting episode, I guess. This has been a very, even thinking about this as I'm talking about it, it's sort of like there's a cynical side of me that hasn't left completely yet. And even though I'm becoming much deeper entrenched in the sort of spiritual side of the journey I'm on, attending church and sort of listening to some of the concepts there that I had been sort of purposely closing myself off to for most of my life, I do feel a certain amount of regret for some of these opinions that I have, or a certain amount of, yeah, you know, there is clearly a judgmental aspect of me. But at the same time, I don't move beyond that. I don't go and actually campaign against, like, I'm not trying to lobby to get rid of OnlyFans. I'm not trying to lobby to take away these avenues for people to make fortunes. I'm just trying to figure out which my avenue is, and will I find it before I die? Will I find it before I'm too old to actually go out? Will there be houses left to buy by the time I do find it? I mean, we have this whole thing with this World Economic Forum telling us all we'll own nothing and be happy. I don't want to live in that world where no one owns anything and that's the only way to be happy. I still am holding out for, even if it's a tiny house. I follow a couple of these accounts on Facebook that put out these AI generated images of concepts for tiny houses. And I'm like, that looks fucking awesome. I would love that shit. It's got a kitchen. It's got a living room. It's got a bed. I'm fine. You know, I don't have to entertain. I do, you know. There is a part of me that envisions having a home big enough to be able to host family and friends to come visit. I do enjoy that. So maybe a tiny home wouldn't be enough necessarily, unless it was not super tiny and in actually had sort of some guest areas to it. But, you know, when I say I want to be rich, it's not because I want a mansion and want people to sort of cater to me. I want to be able to afford life. And we're definitely becoming a world where if you don't have a certain level of wealth, that's never going to be possible. So that's where that comes from. And that's sort of where I'm at. In any case, this has been a long discussion that probably has veered into territory that's probably less than comfortable. And, I don't know. I think every once in a while we all have to do some of this kind of taking stock of what's really going on inside the mind, what needs to be healed, what is healing, what do we really believe. And I feel like we're kind of in a world where that's hard to do sometimes because of this kind of new layer that wasn't there in 1997 when I thought it was going to be just so fucking awesome to go to my 10-year high school reunion. And, we'll check in. Maybe the working stiff is resurfacing here, the cynical working stiff, but, we'll be back with another installment. Again, if there's anything that's resonating with you, or if you want to yell at me, you want to respond to any of the more controversial things I said here, you know how to do it. Hollow9podcast@gmail.com. It's the word hollow, the number 9, INE, all one word. And, you know, feel free to let me know how you guys are doing out there, guys, gals, and all those in between and otherwise. You know, the whole idea is to not be alone. The whole idea is to have other folks to lean on, and I'm very happy to be that. I don't know if there are things I've said here tonight or on this episode that might make people less comfortable seeing me that way. But, you know, it is what it is, I guess. So in any case, thanks for listening. Thanks for being on the journey with me. I think it's, in general, emotionally, it's in a little bit of a different place where it seems to be, at least for myself, I feel like there's less of a, ending the intermission before entering the next act being sort of a fear to be, concerned with. But at the same time, you know, once that fear exists, it never fully goes away. And maybe that'll be the other sign of being healed, or healing has gone to a great place where I can't see that level of darkness coming back. But we'll see. We'll see what happens in the world here. You know, I'm certainly not expecting to go to my 40-year reunion and have it be some kind of magical cure-all, but there will be other things, I think, that will fill the void left behind that level of disappointment. And I can't wait to tell you all about them. If you come back, if this has not been the final episode, for all I know. But anyway, I do want to thank the, you know, tens of people who are... have been listening to all the episodes, and I truly do hope that there are people who are finding some level of camaraderie with the suffering of others that shows them that they're not alone. And yeah, until next time.
You've been listening to a production of the Hollow Nine Network. Feeling It, Healing It, A Diary of Recovery, featuring Dave Maresca. Thank you for listening to Feeling It, Healing It, A Diary of Recovery. Dave Maresca is not a trained medical professional, psychologist, psychiatrist, or licensed professional trained in providing therapeutic mental health care. This podcast is an account of his life experiences and meant to be just that. Any advice or suggestions made in the extemporaneous dialogue of the podcast is not intended to be medical or legal advice. If such advice is what you're seeking, you are encouraged to seek out the services of a licensed professional. The Hollow Nine Network and Dave Maresca assume no liability or responsibility for the information provided in these episodes.